It's not that easy being green, having to spend each day the color of the leaves.
This is Scott Wells with The Magic Word, and today my guest is Steve Trash. Hey, Steve.
Howdy.
Good to see you. I guess howdy, because that's what they say in Alabama. Is that right?
No, we say, hey, y'all.
Oh, well, actually, I guess you're here for the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, and that's howdy is what how they greet you.
Oh, and, you know, I have to say, I have to be very complimentary of the audiences here, and I'm not blowing smoke you. I really love the audiences that come to this rodeo show. Yeah. I'm on what they call the Kids Country Stage, mm-hmm. Which is sponsored by Radio Disney. It's a nice stage. It is outdoors, so there can be challenges there.
Right.
But when the conditions are rough, but the audiences are so nice, it makes my life as a professional entertainer way more better.
Now, what kind of show actually are you doing? I mean, are they illusions? Are they just kind of a stand-up parlor type of thing? And what size of a group do you have? And
I think we've probably got, I've got a nice big stage with lights and a nice big a canvas across the back and a cover. I would probably be considered a medium-sized stage show. I'm not doing an illusion show. They did not. Mm-hmm. They don't have the budget for that on that stage. I usually do 4 shows a day, 25-minute shows, 30-minute shows.
Audience interaction?
Tons. But you know what? If you're ever going to do, I've gotten, over the past 25 years or so, I've gotten pretty good at doing transient shows. Transient meaning the audience is going to walk past. They may stop. They may come to see you. You're not really the reason.
Because it's a free show.
It's a free show.
Yeah, it's like working in a shopping center, because people are on their way to something else.
Yeah, you have to be appealing. It's really similar to what the best trade show magicians do. They have to stop you, make you want to watch them, mm-hmm. then you stay and watch, and then they have to be happy enough to share with the sponsor that they liked what you did.
Right.
And there's a real art to it. When I was a kid, I was reading books. Trade show, street magic, all of that is really similar. You can use a lot of the same gags. But one of the tricks to getting people to participate is make them participate. I open with a really fast magic trick that has a green theme, because everything I do has to do with mm-hmm. With the environment and ecology, and it has been for 26, 27 years. And then I quickly go into something where I have a ball go out into the audience, and I want somebody to stand up and help me.
Right.
Because you either need to physically draw them in, have a volunteer help you with something, or make them hold a prop, or... what I do is I'm going to do a tennis ball thing. So I pitch the tennis ball out. And this is it's a found object. It's something that someone threw away. It was a tennis ball and a can that they threw away. And I get to once again express who I am and what I'm about.
Mm-hmm.
And it draws a kid into the performance. And you simultaneously draw the whole audience into your performance. And I like it too, because doing the same show 3 or 4 times a day, what becomes the most interesting for me are the people. Because I'm going to do the same show.
Right.
I'm going to do the same show. And if you bring something really interesting, if you have, and I mean you, meaning the members of the audience, if I have a cute little 5-year-old kid mm-hmm. that is just beams with happiness.
Oh, yeah. It's infectious.
It is. The audience loves it. You love it. You get excited about being there.
Right.
Day before yesterday.
Makes the show fun for both you and the audience.
Everybody, because it could go in any direction.
Sure.
Day before yesterday, I had this guy. I couldn't even believe this. I mean, I've been a pros for a long time. And people, every once in a while, will surprise you with their questions, right? And you know with your volunteers, right?
Yeah.
The kid in the audience, when you say, oh, I'd like to have a volunteer, the kid that's about to scream, so his head is about to pop off, he's so excited about
it. Me.
Never pick that kid,
right?
Don't pick that kid, and don't pick the kid that's a wallflower looking down. Mm-hmm. Find somebody that's a happy medium. Everybody
Someone
knows.
Who's engaged with the audience, wanting the show.
Somebody who's engaged, but doesn't want to steal the show, right?
Yes.
So everybody knows. Anybody that's a professional entertainer of any kind knows, don't pick the one at the
That's
top.
A good tip for those people who might be listening to this who don't know.
Well, that it's a good one, because go for the one in the middle, because they won't want to steal the thunder and they won't lock up on stage.
Right.
So get somebody in the middle. So I got this guy, a young man, good looking guy, probably, I'm going to guess, maybe Middle Eastern, right? Handsome, very handsome guy. and I ask for a volunteer, okay? Mm-hmm. And this guy's arm shoots up. I don't hardly have anybody else. What I really need is a woman, okay? Because I always use a woman. There's something psychological about this particular illusion. And I'm sort of looking around. It's so obvious that this guy, because he's very close to the stage, has his hand up, and I'm thinking, okay, this could be really bad, but I'm going to live large today. So I select this guy, and he comes up, and the first thing he says when he gets on stage is, "Can I have my own microphone?" And I was like, "Oh wow, dude,
karaoke.
No, you can't have your own microphone." So I turned to the audience because I'm thinking, don't hide this. You know, if you're gonna stick it out there, then stick it out there.
Right.
So I turned to the audience and I say, "He just asked for his own microphone." And I'm inside, my crowd control voice is saying, "Oh, you are in so much trouble." Because this guy is going to go way off map. And you're going to end up in a ditch, to mix metaphors. It was exciting.
Okay.
Because my years of being a street performer and engaging with people, it almost became more fun to see if I had the skill to keep him on that dirt road.
Yeah.
As opposed to him driving off in the ditch and taking the whole show with him. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And I think the only reason that we survived is because I was able to urge him in subtle ways to stay with the program. It turned out he was great.
Yeah.
He didn't need his own microphone. He was really engaged, and he didn't try to. With magic shows, every once in a while we will select the wrong person, and they intentionally want to mess the magician up because somehow it's become a contest or something.
Right, right.
Right. And we try to weed those people out. You know, you can look for signs. They'll tell you who they are. And I kind of thought this guy was one of them, and I think because maybe I'm self-flagellating and I hate myself a little bit, I invited this dude on stage with me. Turned out he was terrific. The audience loved him, and it was a good time. But I frankly enjoyed a little bit of the scariness. Is this going to be magic or not? And it turned out to be terrific.
Well, let me ask you about going back on the developing the concept for trash, and the ecological concept, and the green theme. Now, you've been doing this, you said, for about 26, 27 years or so. So back from the 80s, how did you first get this as an idea?
Well, I was, my dad was a forester and my mother was a teacher, and I spent a lot of time. I was actually born in West Texas, born in San Angelo, but I grew up mostly in Alabama, and I spent a lot of time in the woods. My brother and I, we thought that what people did on Christmas morning was go to the woods for a walk, you know, hiking in the woods. We just thought that's what normal people did. That's what we did, because we spent a lot of time out in the woods. So I had a really good visceral connection to nature. I mean, I spent a lot of time outdoors and still do. And when I was, I think it was about 19, my best friend and I, we had a perfect relationship because he was a technical theater guy and I wanted to be on the stage and he wanted to light the stage and sound the stage. And so we had this perfect thing where we could fix it. We sort of fit together really nicely.
Yeah.
So Alex and I went down to Florida to the Florida State Association of Magicians, I think it was called. And I was lucky enough to meet Marvin Roy, Mr. Electric. And I thought, oh, this is awesome. I've never even met a professional magician in my whole life.
Yeah.
And maybe I had seen one. It was a touring magician. Lord knows who it was. And so I thought, okay, I'm gonna corner. I know who he is. He's been on The Tonight Show. He's been on Ed Sullivan. He's famous.
Right.
I need to talk to him. So and he's always is and was a very generous person. So I cornered him and I said, "Mr. Roy, could I talk to you for a few minutes?" He said, "Of course you can. Come over here." And I said, "I'm studying theater in college. I'm only in college because what I really want to do is be a professional magician. But my mother said, go to college for a year. And if you don't think it's worthwhile, then stop. I'll pay for it for 1 year. But if you think it's worthwhile, stay in there." I got in. I realized that learning about theater and learning about art and making the connections with that university crowd was valuable. but I really want to be a professional magician, and I don't really know how to do that. How do I become, in essence, what you are? And he said, I'll tell you. And so my ears, you know, went the size of two umbrellas, right? Because here's this guy that's been on all these TV shows and stuff. And he said, look, when someone asks for a magician, they have thousands of choices. When they ask for the guy with the light bulbs, they want me.
Right.
He said, go find whatever your light bulb is. He says, Steve, I don't know what your light bulb is, but you've got a light bulb. Figure out what your light bulb is, and you can make a career out of it. And I was either smart enough or stupid enough to realize that was the best career advice I had ever gotten. It didn't have anything to do with a magic trick. I had to go find what personally motivated me. And in my very, you know, sometimes Providence just steps in, or you go down to the crossroads and you just take the right road just for whatever reason. Well, I was already interested in found object artwork. That was the thing that I as much as theater I loved in school, in university, was art that people had made out of objects that other people had thrown away. Because even as a child, I found it fascinating that people would throw away something that I thought was perfectly good. You know, that there was a footlocker or that there was an old picture frame. It just, as a little 7-year-old kid, I was like, that's perfectly good. Why would you throw that away?
Right.
And this kept sort of rattling around in my head. And when Mr. Electric says, go find your light bulb, I thought, well, I would like to do something with trash. I mean, I don't know if that would be interesting to other people, but it sort of fits. And by this time I was 19, so I had started reading Fitzky's trilogy, you know, Showmanship for Magicians, and The Trick Brain was much, much, much more interesting because I could use The Trick Brain almost like a computer. I could plug it in and say, well, I want to do, well, here's a good example, I want to do the zombie.
Okay.
And the zombie ball, of course, traditionally a silver ball. Was it Joe Carson?
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Just a ball and a stick, right?
A ball and stick, right. And I thought, well, just plug it in. Pick a different object. A tennis ball. People throw tennis balls away all the time. They're neon green, so they would show up great from a stage, even if it's a little bit smaller. So I adapted a routine that I have literally done my whole career, because it was practically the first trick I ever did. In fact, and this is really weird, I'm still using the original cloth, the foulard, or whatever they call that, which is an umbrella from the streets of New York, because I was street performing then, that had torn away from the frame, because I wanted to use only found objects in my show. So I took this umbrella, I folded the top of it over, so it was flat across the top, so the ball could rise above.
Sure.
I don't know if the audience ever realizes that the cloth that I'm using is a reclaimed umbrella.
And you don't point that out?
No. Okay. Because it becomes so obvious that I'm trying to get people to look at the world in a different way. Because what I found was, when I found the muse of sharing what I understood almost intuitively about the natural world, that all of these things were connected, that any material object that you ever had, used, could use, was either going to come from the sun or the earth. And I just understood that, bam, like just as a kid. You know, you understand things at your core. And I thought, I should share that, but I should share it in a fun and interesting way. You know, and with magic, you can share across all of these ages. Children and grown-ups, you can share them across cultures. Your language doesn't even matter. You don't have to speak Japanese for them to get what you're doing. You know, you can do in Spanish, you know, you can do magic tricks with basura, or in Japan with gomi, you know. They get, oh, that guy, well, he's doing tricks with stuff that people threw away. And that became the premise of everything that I worked on, was I was giving new life to something someone had discarded. And it's tremendously freeing creatively if you say, okay, I'm not going to use any store-bought props at all. And it's also cheap, because I was really poor. So you just make the props, you know, yourself. And I was a terrible builder. I'm much better at fabricating now than I was.
Now, did you start to do this in theaters or do it with schools? Or, I mean, like early on, then when you started developing this routine and everything, you were working in the streets as a street performer. Mm-hmm. Did you do trash on the streets and then eventually take it into the theater? Or how was that,
jump there? I thought it was going to be reversed because being a theater student, I learned everything about command and control of theater. But I kind of, in my mind, because my only real exposure to magic had been a few television shows, because this was the 70s, you would see, you know, I had seen...
Doug Henning.
Doug Henning, yeah. I had seen... I'd seen Wilson. Phism on television, too.
Okay,
I'd seen Richard Ross.
Right.
I think I'd seen Fred Capps.
Yep. On an HBO special.
Special. I didn't really realize at the time how masterful they were. I just knew, I thought they were amazing.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Norman Wilson.
I thought, okay, about the same time, I also discovered street magic. And... there really weren't any places for me to try things out, because the thing you'll learn as a street performer is you must street perform in a city that has a street culture, right? If your town doesn't have a street culture and you set your bags and things down and start your show, are going to look at you like you're possibly mad, trying to steal something from them. It has to be a city where there is some culture. I know there's some ancient videotape of me in Florence, Alabama, trying to build a tip, you know, trying to slow people down, and they're like running away, you know.
No, wait.
What is that child doing? Stop it! It can't be possibly good. So yeah, I had a dual track. I was studying theater, but in actual fact, the day after I graduated with a degree in theater, which by the way, all of my elective courses were either art or business, because I did realize I wanted to make it a business. I moved to New York City. I mean, literally the day after, I had a girlfriend, and I said, do you want to go to L.A. or New York? And she said, L.A. sounds horrible to me. I'd like to live in New York City. And I was like, fine, New York it is. So we moved to New York City. Man, I couldn't get shot in New York City. So my only choice, because I would go on actors' auditions, because really I was more of an actor than a magician. Even then, even though I knew I wanted to be a magician, I knew more about acting than I did about magic, truly. And the thing about New York at the time, you had South Street Seaport, you had... I lived near Washington Square in the Village, which was crack heaven. It was pretty rough, but an excellent training ground for you becoming a better magician. You know, and I learned the rules of the road, and to this day, in performance, I speak quickly. But I'm from Alabama and Texas. You know, my natural thing is not to speak so quickly, but I just learned that you've got to deliver. It's
That's
New
right.
York, man. Bam, bam, bam.
They're
you do the same thing.
You do. Right.
I've seen you perform, and it is the right way to perform if the audience is not in a theater just to see you. Because if they have the opportunity to walk away or to leave or to do something else, you've got to, in their mind, be saying to them, even if what I'm doing right now is boring, something in 15 seconds is about to come
it's
up that will
change.
Be interesting.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And bam, 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 just hit. And that's what I loved being a theater student, but I learned much more about being a good entertainer by being... by working in
But
New
you
York.
Started doing the green thing about that same time when you went to New York?
Yeah,
then,
I had already started dipping my toes into it, but I got really serious about it in New York because I was working in the southeastern corner of Central Park, which I found to be my best space. It was better than Washington Square because I've always really leaned more towards family audiences. You know, even when I was a young person, I liked family audiences.
And there were more in Central Park area there?
Yeah, because families would come to Central Park. Washington Square was actually hip hop was just getting going. You know, breakdancing. God, this makes me really old. Breakdancing was just now being really hot. And this is when kids were dragging out the cardboard boxes and breakdancing and all that stuff. It was much more sort of a young person's culture. And I did okay with that group. But I was much more of a family kid kind of entertainer. I did that. I was drawn more to that. So I did better in Central Park. Southeastern corner had the Delacorte Clock, which was near the Children's Zoo. So you had this steady stream of people walking through Central Park.
Right.
So they had these nice wide walkways. And... I would find people, when they discovered I was a magician, would literally pick stuff up off the street and say, hey,
do something.
Do a trick with this.
Yeah.
And but if I could do a trick with what they presented me, they considered me a better magician and I was more likely to get a better tip. You know, yeah.
Than having your own props.
Having my own props. Yeah. You know, it was sort of similar to that. To I think Michael Amar has expressed the idea of the sandwich theory, that if you're hungry and you can make a sandwich appear, you're a better magician. In the audience's mind, if they presented me with a challenge, yeah. Do something with this gum wrapper, and right. I did something with that gum wrapper, I was a better magician, you know, and I liked the idea of knowing some utility moves. I was a fan of, you know, at that time of Bobo's book, you know, the coin magic book. It just sure. Learn some utility moves that you could do with anything. And it became increasingly more appealing to me to do tricks with found objects. First of all, in New York, I mean, I had, you know, like 14 roommates in this one-room studio apartment that we lived in. I didn't have any space. I didn't have any money. So I could use props that I just really literally garbage. But I liked the idea of sharing a little bit of message. And my story was always going to be something about reduce, reuse, recycle, or it was going to be about the connections that existed in the natural world, or buying post-consumer recycled papers, or look how much garbage we throw away because there's all of this here. I liked the storyline because we're always telling a story. Even if you don't say anything, you tell a story if you're a magician. To have a ball, to make that ball disappear, is a story.
Right.
Ball was there, ball disappeared. That's a story.
But you also then incorporate, you start to go into some statistics like that about reuse and everything, of which that, do you say how much of a percentage that we throw away? I mean, what you have developed then to now, is it really, would you say more intellectual and educational from the mm-hmm. standpoint that you're throwing maybe some facts and figures at them that you have learned and developed mm-hmm. over the years?
Absolutely right. And you have to do this in a non
preachy way. It's not like you're trying to force some knowledge down their throats.
That's exactly right. It cannot be pedantic at all.
That's what I'm trying, yeah.
Right? And in fact, here's a perfect example. Here at the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, they are the most, and I mean this in the best way, the most sort of middle America audience you're going to ever find.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to share something that you know about the environment, first of all, it needs to be true. Second of all, it needs to be interesting. And third of all, it needs to be integrated into what you're just doing.
Right.
And I close this particular show with a version of Healed and Sealed, the aluminum can.
Oh, sure.
Well, about 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000 years ago, John Kennedy came out with the first version that I ever saw. And I've been performing it since sometime in the 80s. I don't really remember when we first started it. And his version was pretty much a miracle. And over the years, I have adapted it. And I'm patting myself on the back a little bit. I just performed it in Portugal summer before last. And of all people, Gaetan Bloom came up to me afterwards and he says, this is beautiful. This is beautiful.
Wow. Right.
Yeah, that's what I said, because I'm like, really? You know, after I stopped peeing myself, because I just got a compliment from Gaetan Bloom.
Yeah.
You know, then we hustled off into the corner. I said, this is what I'm doing. You know, so I can take that illusion and share, for instance, here's an example. I hope most of your magician listeners know this, but if you take an empty aluminum can and you make it into a new aluminum can, you literally save 95% of the energy that it takes to make an aluminum can. So to make a new can out of recycled aluminum only takes 5% of the energy, right?
Because it's already made.
Yeah. You've already done the hard work of getting the bauxite ore mined and, you know, getting the process made.
Sure.
And that is something that I can actually put into my show, and it doesn't come off like I'm trying to save souls or put you in school. It's just, you know, it's just part of the, it's organically a part of the performance.
Sure.
And you have to be very careful about never coming off preachy. It's the, I see, gospel magicians that, that's interesting, they're preachy. They get so much into the message that they forget that they're supposed to be entertaining first, because you can draw people into your message if you're clever.
Certainly.
You know, if you're clever, make sure you know what the kernel of the idea is that you want to get across. And if you can get that idea across through the trick, you've accomplished it. You don't even have to say anything.
Right. So the message actually is secondary to the mystery that you're presenting, you're saying.
They flip back and forth.
So in other words, I'm just thinking that afterwards the people are thinking, wow, that really fooled me. And then later, 2 days from there, they're thinking also about the message that was behind that mystery.
Correctamundo. I call it sneaking in the back door.
Okay.
Right? Because they came to be made happy.
Yeah.
That's why they stopped in to see you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can share something about their connection to the natural world in a really subtle going home kind of way,
mm-hmm.
let's say they're in that, the going home trick, say, they're the ones that you talk about. The family gets in the car, and the kid in the back says, as they're going home, did you see him make that aluminum can fill back up again? And that family is going to talk about it on the way home.
Yeah.
Right? And my hope is that they also say, and I had no idea that recycling actually saved that much energy. Saving energy is an important thing. Maybe we should be a little bit more diligent about recycling. You know, but that's my hope. There are other much more subtle ways, like using Ted the tennis ball in performance.
Ted, so you actually call your tennis ball?
Okay. He gets fan mail.
Kind of like Tom Hanks, I guess, had with his
volleyball. That's right. It's exactly the same idea. And if you personify, that's another attitude that I have about my props. How I saw Cardini early on, I don't know. But I believe I saw a film of Cardini performing on television because I knew what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the magic happened to him. Right?
Right.
The objects were animate. Now, he was doing some crazy good stuff himself. But to the audience, he was doing nothing.
Right.
He was a character with
things
all
are
of
just
this
happening around
happening.
Him. Yeah.
Well, I've discovered that because I'm talking about the magic of these objects, the objects in my show should have their own, they should possess their own magic. Mm-hmm. And it becomes even more hilarious when Ted the tennis ball begins to float. And then he starts whacking me in the head,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Because, and this is funny to kids, because
right,
he becomes
right.
his own little personality,
mm-hmm.
and then he eventually, I threaten him with a tennis racket, and he vanishes, right? And I can get across the idea without saying any more. First, I just say he's a found object. I found him.
Mm-hmm.
I glued a couple of eyes on him. I cut a little bitty mouth. His name is Ted. And instantly the audience goes, oh, it's a tennis ball. I've even had children, whole classes, have made their own versions of Ted. I mean, some of them had dreadlocks,
yeah.
and they've sent me pictures, like dreadlocks, and
funny.
Some of them had little bows in there. And this is the idea, because as much as I adore magic tricks, and I do, and magicians, I love both of them, the thing that actually wakes me up in the morning is I can use my ideas to be transformative in society, and magic gets to be the vehicle that I use.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a television show. It could be artwork that you hang on the wall. You know, artists are driven by an idea. They're not driven by the medium. You know, the medium for me is simply magic tricks.
Right.
The idea, what I want to get out there, is that the connections that exist in the natural world, it's really important that we understand them well.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't understand them well, we make poor decisions. If we do understand them well, we make excellent decisions. And I try to use my entertainment and my show to do that. Some days I'm completely unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm.
Some days I'm very successful at it because I'm constantly walking the tightrope of I have to be entertaining to this audience. Whether they take any eco message away from it or not, I need to be funny. I need to be magical. I need to make sure that my client thinks I'm worth whatever money they paid me to be here. And so for them, the message I think is important, but it becomes of no value if if the TED routine wasn't solid, if you will, if they can see the string holding the tennis ball up in the air,
right,
it loses its value. You know, it's almost like the messenger. If you're not a good quality messenger, the message becomes bad.
What you're talking about here is so closely aligned, then, Steve, to a trade show. It's just uncanny,
mm-hmm,
in which that you're having to stop an audience, having to entertain them, and the magic is just a vehicle to deliver the message, and the message is whatever that the client is trying to sell, whether it's a service, a product, or something, and they have to be happy with what you have done, and you have to have educated the people who are coming through the trade mm-hmm show about that particular product. Now, is your main audience typically, again, schools, or are you going really to county fairs, state fairs, a little bit of mixture of both? I mean, who is your audience? Do you direct them to, obviously it's to adults as well as children,
mm-hmm,
when you're in fairs, but I assume in schools as well.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is kind of, what is that mix between the two?
I've always believed in diversification, and so pretty early on I realized that I needed to, you know, people that have portfolios, they diversify. They don't put all of their stocks in one particular sector. If one goes south, then you're really in trouble.
That's right.
So I realized that I could get involved. For instance, my years as a street performer, I literally stumbled into doing state and county fairs. You know, thank the Lord, the first fair I ever did in my whole life was the State Fair of Texas in Dallas, which was like 27 days long. It was the marathon of fairs.
Yeah.
It's hot as Hades, let me tell you, folks. It's even in October, it's hot.
Yeah.
However, it was a brilliant introduction because being a street performer for years had taught me all of the techniques that I needed to work out in front. It turns out years later I discovered that this same stage, which was the Miller Lite, the Miller Genuine Draft stage, was the same space that Mark Wilson for years had done his Dr. Pepper show.
Mm-hmm.
It's in exactly that same space. But I was just this kid doing street magic out front in between the main headliner acts. You know,
an eco-friendly kind of a theme.
Always.
Okay.
I did this dumb thing. I mean, every once in a while, I mean, I was a young kid and I was really into theater, so every once in a while I would do stuff that was really esoteric and I thought was hilarious. And I would call it because the audience just didn't get where I was coming from. But I remember finding a really old battered cardboard box. And now this is going to sound so bizarre in retelling, and I tied a little rope to it as if it were a dog, right? And I was walking this dog like I was some sort of crazy person.
Walking a box. Okay.
Yeah. So I was walking this really ratty old torn up box. And my sense of being an actor in theater, I just found this personally hilarious, but the audience totally didn't get it. In fact, I think the only place, the first day I was at State Fair of Texas, I'm pretty sure that Errol Flynn tried to have me kicked off the grounds because I looked like I was a bum. You know, I looked like I was actually a street person. Because at the time, I was going for a really authentic theatrical approach. And I eventually came to discover that you can't do that if you're a street person. If you're doing street magic, you have to look somewhat character-y. You can't look like if you are on the street and you look like you don't have a house, you are a street person as far as that person walking past is. So you have to sort of ramp up what you're doing. So back to your original question, I learned about street performing and I was able to move into the fair circuit, the fair market, state mm-hmm fairs, county fairs. And today that consists of about a third of my touring schedule. And then, I spent years doing school shows, but I found that I'm much happier playing performing arts venues where they bus in kids to see my trash and recycle show.
Now, is that through those types of phone room shows you're talking about then, or no?
No. This would be part of an arts series.
Okay.
So, for instance, they're going to have the play Hansel and Gretel.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have a touring dance group. Well, they actually reach out to regional schools and say, this is a part of our cultural arts series, and I get to be plugged in to 800, 1,500 seat theaters, and I do a show for them where they bust the kids in.
That's part of that series.
That's part of that series.
And you would just have a standalone show, and then the next week might be the Hansel and Gretel, and next week's Peter and the Wolf. And so,
correct.
So you're not actually part of the Hansel and Gretel show or something.
No, I'm not. Yeah, exactly. I'm a headliner. I'm a headliner that's for what I mean. That. And they have to reach out. And the main ticket for that is that you must be educational. That one, that flips the equation on its head. They care way more about reduce, reuse, recycle, and how the water cycle works. And
they want more details and statistics and all that.
And quite specifically, they want you to even match their core curriculum, what the teacher has to teach.
So they will send you in advance, I'm sure, what they're teaching or want you to teach them.
They flip it. You go to my website, and you can click on your state and see if my show matches which item, which page of the core curriculum, because they have to go and be able to sell it to the folks that are paying for the buses and all of that kind of stuff.
The theaters that are selling it, or no? Are we talking about the schools, or who is it that's looking at that?
Mostly really the, it's both, you know, but really and truly who I'm trying to reach are the teachers, because they're going to go to the administrator and try to convince them that it's worth spending the money.
So when you're trying to sell your show, you're selling to the teachers, to the administrator, the principal?
No, originally I'm selling to the performing arts venue.
Okay.
To the venue. And then once that's done, I have additional materials for the venue to give to the teachers, because they still have to fund it. Because you still have to basically, it's, you know, it's no different than, say, David Copperfield, other than he's a bazillionaire and I make like $12 ever.
You're a hundredaire.
Yeah, I'm a hundredaire. But it's essentially the same. You know, David's going to get his fee to go into a venue, and then that venue's got to fill the seats, right? It's essentially the same.
True.
I'm going to go into this performing arts venue. But it's going to be a morning show, and school kids from all over that region are going to be bussed in to see this show. Now, they're not going to come to see me because I'm Steve Trash, because I'm not famous, I'm not on their television, I don't have any kind of cue is the old expression. I don't know what the new one is, but, you know, I don't have I'm not a celebrity,
mm-hmm.
Okay? So I have to come up, I have to provide tools for that venue to get those butts in seats, to get those school kids there. And so what we try to provide are resources for them, you know, lesson plans.
So after your show is over, the teachers can go back and talk to the students saying, now what did we learn today, kids?
You exactly know, kind right. of a thing. And in advance, what they like to do is...
Before they go, so they can listen for things.
They listen for that specific thing.
Yeah.
Will you discover, well, what is the water cycle? You know, I mean, kids come in and they know what evaporation, transpiration, precipitation are. Before they come in, and they get it reinforced during the show, or the magic words are reduce, reuse, recycle. They know that beforehand, and the teacher can go into, well, what do we mean by waste reduction? You know, when does a resource become something you consider to be trash or mm-hmm. garbage? You know,
about solar energy and other kinds of things, or is that something completely...
I stay away from energy only because I try to harp on one thing, and in this particular one, the focus is trash. But yeah, I would love to do an energy show.
I was going to say, that's almost a whole separate thing, you know, with hydroelectric and different kinds of wind power and solar.
Well, the truth is, the future, because I read about this a lot, because I'm developing a magical keynote lecture right now, but for business, for grown-ups.
Mm-hmm.
I had the best experience working at the Magic Castle back in July, because I don't get to do just adult shows.
Mm-hmm.
It's always either kids and families. Well, it's always kids and families. And I never do just grown-up shows. Mm-hmm. And it was so fantastic to be at the Magic Castle where it was all grown-ups and they all came to see magic. Because I never get that. I never, ever, 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 ever get people that show up that love magic.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to talk people. Every show I do, I have to talk you into the fact that you will enjoy this magic
show.
That's
right. That's right.
The other thing is I always have children. With that audience, they're more sophisticated and they came prepared
at the Magic
because
Castle,
they
sure.
love magic.
That's right.
I wailed. I was in the, what do they call it, Hat and Hair Lounge. And I did like 4 hours straight, and I could have done another four. It was so, you know, the ambiance is so lovely there anyhow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it was, I just enjoyed that. And, you know, it was really similar to the street performing. You know, it was a very sort of an organic thing, you know, but I really enjoyed the adult audiences. But that was, you have to know who your audience is. And most of my audience is going to be a kid/kid grown up. audience.
Let me ask you then, kind of to start to wrap up at least a little bit here, would be what advice that you might give to others who are looking for that light bulb? Is there something good advice like that Marvin Roy had given you?
Yeah, I don't think my advice would be as articulate as his was, because that's perfect advice. It's just go find your own light bulb. Mark Kornhauser, several years ago, like a long time ago, said, if you're looking for who you are as a character, and at the time, the most popular magician, when I was really, really looking, the most popular magician in the world was David Copperfield. And I knew, don't try to look like David. He's handsome. He's very stylish. But you
see so many clones. Like, you know, when Lance Burton had one phism, then he was on Johnny Carson. Everybody wanted to have that kind of vampire look.
First of all, you're never going to be as good looking as Lance Burton. I'm sorry. Just stop.
He's a handsome man.
Just stop. He's a good looking dude.
Right.
And he's incredibly talented magically. You look at yourself in the mirror, honestly. You know, I had an argument with my advertising professor at university. I did my final project on myself. He said, create a marketing advertising campaign. And I said, ooh, good. So yeah. I get to create a campaign. I get class credit. And I said, I want to be visually different than anyone. So I adopted this hat. I wanted to wear, I was a huge fan of Lewis Carroll and Through the Looking Glass and Alice in Wonderland.
Right.
And the Mad Hatter hat is very, very specific. It's not a Lincoln chimney hat. It bells out on top.
Yes.
And I liked that look a lot. And I said, that's what I want. It will be instantly recognizable as a magician's hat. But other than Sylvester the Jester, I defy you to come up with anybody else that's well known that wears a belled out hat. And at that time, even Sylvester wasn't out there. Just no one did. And I wanted a look, you know?
Yes.
And I said, okay, I'm going to wear this hat, and then I'm going to wear these sort of patchy jeans, and I will be a unique character. And my professor came back and he said, look, you're a good looking kid. You really don't need to wear that hat. And I said, you're wrong. I want this look to be iconic. Mm-hmm. I literally want you to see my silhouette and know, oh, that's Steve Trash.
Mm-hmm.
You know, call that ego, call it whatever you want. But I knew, and frankly, I've suffered from that, because I've had magicians sort of discount me because I was sort of like, they didn't get what I was actually doing.
Right.
Or, frankly, attempting to do. Because I'm willing to fail in attempts and look stupid because I'm actually going for something that I can envision.
Just like pulling that box you were talking about earlier.
Yes. And that was a
afraid.
Failure.
Yeah.
But
at least you
tried. But it was interesting to me, artistically, it was interesting to pull that box around like it was a dog or something. But
developing that character and having the hat and being iconic. I mean, you know, like Willy Wonka, I think about with the hat. It's
right.
Type of the thing, you know.
That's right. And in fact, I loved Willy Wonka. My grandmother, who was from Texas, from Dallas, made me a purple velvet Willy Wonka jacket when I was about 12.
Yeah.
And I think that may be the place. Oh, but Kornhauser's idea was this. He said, take three characteristics of your own personality, no more, and magnify them. Take three. Just pick them. Pick the ones that work for you. You know, I'm an okay looking guy. And at that time, I was definitely not as, say, sort of sophisticated and suave as David Copperfield was, or as sort of kooky and friendly as, say, Doug Henning was. So I needed to find my own, you know, my own thing. Yes, my own chi, exactly. And so I started kind of with a look, and I let the personality come out. I mean, I know I identified some specific characteristics, and I tried to magnify those. Because on stage, you're really a simple character.
Well, remember, Bill Palmer was lecturing about this recently, and you and I heard him talk about where you're developing a character, scripting, that you develop the character first, and then you develop a script of what that character would say or do, or what kind of tricks they would do. So you developed your character, you're saying. So your three things were that you had developed were what? You had the hat, and then...
Yeah, largely I went that I was friendly, charming, and just slightly puckish. Like, I might steal your wallet.
Yeah.
On purpose.
So people have to be wary.
They would need to be keep their distance just a little.
Just a little bit, right.
Because I might get hustled by this guy.
Yeah.
You know, the other advice that I would give to magicians out there, if they're really interested in making a career, is just keep working harder at trying to be better. I mean, my whole career, I've taken lots of risks and failed abysmally. I mean, I launched a show in LA. I rented the venue, Theater on Hollywood Boulevard, and literally the magic press said, "Well, someone's finally done it. A show about the environment." That was the review, right? I was like, "Well, yeah, it was probably 1990 or so, and I think they just didn't get what I was going for, but I just took that on the chin and went, you know what, okay, fine. I can see where the prize is. I just keep working for the prize." So I would say to those entertainers, magicians out there, try to figure out where the prize is for you and then chase that, and that will drive all the decisions you make, the way you look, the character choices that you make, because who knows where they will go. I mean, there are some very interesting magicians out there right now, you know, making some really interesting choices.
True.
And, you know, we're in sort of a transformative period where it could be very exciting or very depressing for magicians right now.
Right.
You know? But I would say just keep working at being better. And if if the people that are floating around don't get what you're doing, then just stay at it and keep
tweaking it, I guess.
Yeah, keep trying to be better. If you see that it's bad, then work to be better. I was not a very good magician when I started, you know. And I technically am not a brilliant magician now. But again, my goal was always to share that message through the magic. I don't think you should ever compromise the quality of the magic, though, for the message.
And the message, again, there's always been kind of the ecosystem and the green environment. And that is something, of course, has gotten to be hot over the last several years in particular. I mean, gosh, you know, since the 60s or 70s, you know, zero population growth and, the Earth Day, you know, first, you know, came out and everything. But then it kind of took a backseat, you know, since the 60s until just now with, you know, plastic bottles and recycling and everything. And so I'm sure that there are a lot of schools who want to do that. And so it seems that magicians are now trying to get caught up with Steve Trash. Like, you've been doing this, like, forever.
Right.
And so for those who might be thinking that, well, gee, I'd like to be able to provide some sort of ideas to schools now, where can they get these kinds of information, or would you encourage them to do that? I mean, I would think there's enough room for everybody out there.
Oh, there's totally enough room. And, you know, the truth is, my first goal, to be funny about it, my first goal is to save the planet. So the more magicians that are actually working, here's the thing. Saving the planet is a misnomer. The planet's going to be fine. It's humanity that may actually be in trouble if we continue to make poor decisions. And the poor decisions would be pretty simple, pretty straightforward. We have to actually work to make sure that future generations use resources now so we don't steal the opportunity for future generations to use those resources.
Mm-hmm.
That's called sustainability, and that's my prime directive, is to get that message out there. And if there are other magicians that want to hop into the fray, and their heart's in the right place, and they want to do that same thing, I'm like, bring it on. Come on. I mean, Stan Allen was kind enough to do a green issue of Magic Magazine, and I was lucky enough to be on the cover, and I had a whole bunch of other magicians that contributed material, and they had been doing green and environmental shows for years and years. And we even have some tricks. I had everybody submit tricks. It didn't end up in the magazine. And who knows? We may someday release those as an ebook or something. So magicians that maybe don't have an idea of what to do, but they know they want to do something with the environment, maybe we can make that available or something. So, yeah, heck yeah, I would love it if there were more people doing the green thing.
That'd be great. You know, I was thinking that if that really got to be more and more popular, where we have, you know, Fellowship of Christian Magicians, and we got Clown Magicians and Kadabra, different kinds of conventions for specifically unique magicians or areas, I guess I should say. It could be that eventually that there'd be something just for ecological magician. Mm-hmm. You know,
well, think about the areas you've got. You've got pollution. You've got how does the ecological world work? You've got the water cycle. You know, you've got waste reduction. You've got energy. You know, we're talking about. I would love to write an energy show because the material is there. There's so much that you could share with people, and it just goes on and on and on. If you keep it about the environment, and the one thing I learned in my research. The founder of Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream, Ben Cohen, was a very activist type of guy.
Mm-hmm. And still is.
And he said one of his really bad campaigns that just didn't get any support, and he said what we failed was to give them the positive. We told them all of the negative, all of the bad stuff that was happening, but we didn't give our supporters anything positive to do. And frankly, there have been tons of environmental magazines that have come along years and years and years, and those guys are all gone, mm-hmm. and I'm still here. And the reason I'm still here is because the message has always been about empowering people. Here's what you can do. Yep, we definitely have a problem. Recognize what that problem is.
Here are some solutions.
Here are lots of solutions that you can integrate into your life, and you can spread the message. And by the way, it's going to be fun. And that's why I don't even call myself a magician in my promotional materials. I call myself a rockin' eco hero. So it becomes almost like a concert experience because I write music. I have a Mac, so you can create music on a Mac like you're some kind of brilliant musician or something, you know? And really, it's just putting loops together and mixing and matching.
Yeah.
And GarageBand. So yeah, I welcome the company. If you've got listeners out there that want to, heck, send me an email, you know, if you're interested, we will. All of those guys that submitted green material, we'll just put a book up there, make an ebook out of it or something like that. Because that would make me incredibly happy to have lots of other young, old, it doesn't matter, just people, magicians that want to get in the green thing.
Well, where can people get in contact with you if they want to send some ideas to you or ask you for ideas?
SteveTrash.com.
And your email will be steve@stevetrash.com.
I think it's some terrible email nowadays. I think it's stevetrashrockandecohero@gmail.com. That's a long story. So
basically, they should probably go to stevetrash.com.
Yeah, stevetrash.com, because then you can just click the thing. Yeah, click the contact me. You can find me on Facebook, but except for you, Scott, sometimes Facebook eludes me. I have lots of friends, and I have a tiger by the tail when it comes to social networking. You know, mm-hmm. I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook and I'm on LinkedIn and Google Plus and all that.
People want to follow you on Twitter. What's your Twitter?
Green Steve Trash. Green Steve Trash. And yeah, that's interesting because we do occasionally put up what we call green magic moments. My notion years ago, a couple years ago, was to do very simple, straightforward sleight of hand magic tricks, a chop cup or a pendemonium, you know, the safety pin through the safety pin, and express a very simple ecological idea. And so I have, I don't know, maybe 50 of those up on YouTube. And so I will put those either on Twitter or on Facebook just to let people look at them. Mm-hmm. You know, again, my goal is to get the green thing out there. But at the same time, make sure the magic is interesting, you know, to people. Because don't do anything poor. And is it why even come to the game if you're not going to play well, right?
Right.
I mean, we were talking about this earlier. I'm a competitive person. I literally wake up every day thinking, how can I be a little better today than I was yesterday at whatever the endeavor mm-hmm. is? An example would be that recycled aluminum can. 2 years ago, when I was in Portugal, I was lucky enough to be invited there for the Encontros Magicos and Lisboa Magic by Luis de Matos, right? And there are all these great magicians from all over the world. And I went there with the goal of having a good time, but of making that recycled aluminum can killer. By the time I came home, because I was going to do lots and lots and lots of shows a day, my goal was, because you know, with a street audience, you know whether it's killer, because they tell you right then, right there. If it's lousy, they're, you know, a big yawns from the audience.
Right.
But when that thing goes pop, pop, and the coke comes spurting out of there, and you pour it into the, they're clapping and cheering,
sure.
That's a magical moment. So that was my goal. at the beginning was, I know this is okay. I've done it for years and it's okay. But it's got the potential to be really good. And I just hammered and hammered and hammered. And by the end of that run, you know, it was solid.
Well, as we close, let me just ask one last thing, because the title of this podcast is called The Magic Word. Mm-hmm. So my question to you then, what is your magic word? Not necessarily something that you would use in the show in the context of, you know, making something magic happen, but it could be a lifestyle. It could be something that you live by, a mantra. It could be something that you do use in your show. But what would be Steve Trash's magic word?
You know, I'm going to have to go with the magic word is reduce, reuse, recycle. That's
you.
My word. Yeah.
That'd be great. Steve, thank you again very much for being my guest over here.
You should do this more often.
Oh, yeah.
Good questions.
We should have more people listen than also expand.
Well, I'll spread the word.
Yeah, very good.
We'll put it on Facebook and Twitter and all that business.
We'll get it going. Steve Trash, thank you very much. And for now, for the magic word, this is Scotty out.
I'm green and it'll do fine, and it's beautiful, and I think it's what I want to be.